also in the studio tonight is our guest Rob Sawyer, who's written this great book. I've got it in front of me here, The Prince of Centre Halves, The Life of Tommy, otherwise known as T.G. Jones. Rob, good evening. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the book. How long did it take to put it all together, Rob?
A labour of love, probably about 2 years' work on and off when I could fit in the time. I hope it's worth it. It's certainly been a fascinating thing to research.
Before we start talking about the book, a little bit about yourself. Obviously an Evertonian.
Absolutely, yep.
So life. Are you excited at all these signings, first of all, that we've just been hearing
about?
It's
a real step change, isn't it, in the club. It's, exciting times. One or two things to resolve still with maybe the number nine situation or the striker situation, maybe a central defender, but definitely very promising signs to see us getting business done so early in the window. It's fantastic.
You're also involved with the Toffee Web independent Everton website, I think I'm right in saying as well, and also the Everton Heritage Society, which we'll talk about as well. So what are your earliest memories of Everton? Who were the players that you grew up sort of idolising?
Good question. My first, I'm in my mid-40s, so the first players I really remember were Dave Thomas on the left wing, Bob Latchford, Andy King. Those are probably my first heroes, but I was lucky to become a regular in the early 80s, so just in time for those wonderful mid-80s years under Howard Kendall, and I worship players like Kevin Sheedy, Trevor Stephen, etc.
And how did you get involved with the Heritage Society?
I was invited to join by the chairman at the time, a chap called Paul Wharton. I was starting to work on a biography of Harry Catterick, and Paul invited me to join a society, which has been a real boon for me, just being able to spend time and learn from other experts on the club. So probably about 3 or 4 years with the Heritage Society, and I've been contributing articles to Toffee Web about Everton's history probably for about 4 or 5 years.
So would you describe yourself then, Rob, as a historian of the game or of Everton, if you like?
Well, particularly Everton, but one great thing when you're researching these books is it's not just about your club. You learn about the game in general, other clubs. A lot of this particular book is about Welsh football, for example. Mm. So it's great just to learn about the game more generally.
And it's not your first book, certainly, on Everton, is it? Because you wrote a book about Harry Catterick as
That's
well.
That's right, which that came out a couple of years ago.
And he was a fascinating character, wasn't he?
Yeah, an enigma to many. But along with Howard Kendall, up there in our top two managers of all time. And that was a wonderful thing to learn. And obviously people remember Harry Catterick as a wonderful manager, but it was also the fact that he'd been an Everton player before, and that was what led me on to, in a way, T.G. Jones and this project. It was researching Harry Catterick's playing days in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah.
Of course, T.G. was a teammate of his, and just reading those match reports, it emphasised what a player T.G. Jones was.
And just briefly on Harry Catterick, I mean, everyone says about how he was so respected but not necessarily loved, because
Absolutely.
He was a difficult man to sort of love, if you like, because he was such a stern kind of character, really,
stern,
wasn't he? That's the impression I get.
Yeah, disciplinarian, stern, kept his distance from the players. So there was no great love for him, I think that would be fair to say. Respect, yes. Colin Harvey greatly admired him because Colin was brought through by Harry and developed. But it would be true to say that he was nothing like your Bill Shankly. He was a quiet man, a very private man, who kept his distance both from the supporters and the players. But the results speak for themselves.
Absolutely, yeah, what a record he had. Is it enjoyable putting these books together, or does it get a bit of hard work and a bit of a chore, or do you really get into it?
Yeah, you do get into it. I don't know if my wife would say it was enjoyable with me. Hiding away in the study, but yeah, it is fascinating because it just leads you down past you weren't expecting. Like I say, sort of the research on Welsh football, his international career. So yeah, it is great. You can really get carried away with it. It's hard to rein it in sometimes.
And you alluded to it there, Rob, about how you sort of, because of the Catterick connection, you got into T.G. Jones. Was that how it started, or why did you choose T.G. as your man for this book?
Well, clearly T.G. has always been a giant. You know, my dad saw him play and would speak about him. You only have to read any Everton history book and you'd see how he's rated as one of the greatest centre-halves we've ever had. But that's all you really would read about it. So researching about Catterick, reading those match reports, you just began to understand just how highly rated he was by the journalists of the time and his teammates. So that got me interested, but it was then by chance I was helping a Bangor City supporter with some research into one of their former players, and of course, Tommy, T.G. Jones, managed Bangor City. And this chap was just eulogising about the impact that Tommy had on North Wales football after he'd left Everton. And that piqued my interest, and it went from there, really.
Is he the forgotten man of English football, British football?
I think you could say that he is. There's a sound argument for it. If you said the name Tommy Jones or T.G. Jones to a lot of football supporters now, they wouldn't know him unless perhaps you were an Everton fan or a fan of maybe Bangor City. So, yes, he probably is. But you could probably say that for a number of players who were in that era, to be fair, especially who lost a lot of their career to the wartime.
Mm. We were talking earlier off mic, Rob, about the fact that in 2000 here on Radio Merseyside we did a poll, the team of the century it was, and invited listeners to gather together a Merseyside team in position, the best of the century, if you like. And T.G. Jones was in that team alongside, I think, Alan Hansen in the end. And we'll talk about the style of player that he was. I suppose he and Alan Hansen, in a way, different eras, of course, but quite similar in the way they played the game.
Yeah, I think it's a fair comparison. Both cultured players. They didn't need to have great pace. They could read the game. They were comfortable on the ball. They could bring the ball out of defence. So, yeah, I mean, speaking to quite a few Everton fans, they would be adamant that TG was the better player, of course. But yeah, definitely some comparisons there with Alan Hansen.
And Kevin Ratcliffe writes the foreword, doesn't he, for the book as well. Was T.G. Jones somebody he was aware of, if you like?
Yeah, and obviously Everton fans, when he was a player, some of the older fans would come and talk to him and say that, you know, you're a great player, but, you know, T.G. was the best. So he's had it from supporters.
We've already had a caller come on to us. Derek and McGullough's called in, Rob. He says he wants to know if you maybe came across Joe Rutter in your research. He says he was Joe was Derek's granddad and he was best mates with T.G. Jones. He was Joe was a Tranmere player and lived in Anfield, and T.G. Jones lived around the corner. So it's amazing the kind of connections you get, yeah. People listening in. But, of course, Everton have always been known for their centre-halves, haven't they? They've got a great tradition. People talk about the number nines, but also at the other end of the pitch as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, before I came on, I was thinking about the great centre-halves that we've had through the ages. You know, if you go back to TG's era, you had people like Charlie G, Tommy White, who were England internationals. TG was followed by T.E. Jones. Then you've got Brian Lebone, John Hurst, Mike Lyons, Dave Watson, Kevin Ratcliffe. You know, you're absolutely right. That sort of number five shirt is equally illustrious, I think, in Everton's history.
And was he always known as T.G.? Because Tommy George, wasn't it?
Thomas George Jones is his name. I think the T.G. came from the fact that match reports, often in those days, would just refer to players by their initials, so it would be T.G. Jones. And on Merseyside, that stuck. So very much on Merseyside, he's T.G. But if you go back to his Welsh homeland, it's Tommy Jones. That's what most people refer to him as over there.
So were you able to get in touch with players of that era, many still around who knew him and played with him? And who did you interview, you know, for the book?
Obviously, I put out an appeal through local newspapers, social media, trying to track down as many people as possible who had either played with him or seen him play. In terms of Everton, the only person who was still alive from that era at the time was Tom Gardner, who happily assist me with research. I did manage to track down a lot of people who actually watched TG play, especially in those post-war years, and to a man they were, you know, they just all eulogized about how he played. Also, I tracked down people who played with him later in his life at Puthelly, Bangor City as well. So yes, it was a big appeal, trying to track down as many people as possible.
I suppose the great frustration when we're talking about this era is there's so little footage, isn't there?
Absolutely.
I don't know if there's much about at all of TG, is
there? Hardly any. There's a bit of sort of Pathé News footage from a couple of wartime international games, and that's about it, which is such a shame. But that's why it is important to speak to these people who saw him while these people are still with us and get that sort of first-hand testimony as to just how great a player he was.
Yeah, and there's a quote from Dixie Dean on the front cover of the book. It says, "Tommy was the best all-round player I have ever seen." And that's high praise coming from Dixie.
Yeah, high praise from the main man. And all the more remarkable when you think that TG and Dixie only played two first-team games together. They played in the reserves for the best part of a year, but it just goes to show what an impact TG made on Dixie in quite a short space of time.
And as well as playing, albeit briefly there, as you say, with Dixie, I mean, you're talking about players like Joe Mercer and Tommy Lawton, and there was the title in his second season, I think, with Everton.
Yeah, only his first full season, his second sort of season as a regular in the team, and they unexpectedly romped to the league championship in 1938-39. And people who were there, people old enough to remember, say it was maybe the most scientific of Everton teams. It was a wonderful blend of talent, as you say, some star names like TG, Joe Mercer, Tommy Lawton, the great Ted Sagar in goal, but a blend of talent. He had sort of hard men like Billy Cook and Norman Greenalsh in the fullback positions, the great Alex Stevenson at inside forward. So it was a wonderful side, but of course, just months after they secured that championship unexpectedly, war broke out and ruined everything.
Yeah, and again, we'll come on to that era as well. And he was, I think, very close to both Joe Mercer and Tommy Lawton. In fact, he was the best man at both their weddings, wasn't he?
He was best man for Joe Mercer.
Was he? Yeah.
Yes, he was indeed. And he was a big buddy with Tommy Lawton. They joined Everton around about the same time, so they were the two new kids on the block, and they definitely stuck around together, both very smartly dressed young men, both confident in their own abilities. Yeah, they were inseparable, and then Joe, just slightly older, Joe became a lifelong friend of TG's. They would go on holiday together and stayed in touch for the rest of their lives.
So that much, I mean, on the pitch, that would have helped to have been such a tightly knit group, if you like.
That's right. It's about team spirit, and all of them attributed their success when they won the league to going on taking part in a tournament in Scotland that previous summer, and it was that bonding element of being together for a few weeks on that tour in Scotland that really brought them together for that championship season.
Mm. And then, of course, as you say, the war came along and changed everything for all players. I mean, players in their prime losing, what, seven years of their careers.
Seasons of competitive football were lost. And as you say, those players like Stevenson, TG, Joe Mercer, those were just coming into their prime years. Of course, they still played, and that's one aspect of this book that people think that there was almost no football for 7 years. There was football, there was wartime leagues. It's just unfortunate for people like TG that they were playing probably their best football in an era when there's very little record of it. You read the match reports, TG was unassailable. In those sort of early 40s, you read every match, it was just like TG was the best player on the pitch, just so classy, so cool. But we don't really remember it, and they're not even recorded now as official matches.
And did he always play for Everton in the wartime period? Because you often hear of players playing for other teams, mm-hmm. because everything was different around then.
Yeah, he was generally based just across the border at Harden, just over in Wales, so he managed to get back to Goodison for most weekends. He did appear occasionally for teams like Swansea Town, as they were then, Tranmere, Wrexham, who were his first club. He played half a dozen games for Wrexham before Everton snapped him up in 1936. But TG, because he was based locally, did play a heck of a lot of games for Everton in the war.
Mm. Did he see action in during the war?
No, hardly any footballers did. Most of them were drafted in as physical training instructors in one of the armed forces. So TG briefly worked in an aircraft factory building Wellington bombers, but then he joined the RAF as a physical training instructor. Same as the same job was done by Lawton, Mercer, nearly all of the players.
Really?
That era.
I didn't realise that.
Yeah, I think there was a reluctance to send these people to the front because they were famous, and it's probably better for morale to have them training the new recruits.
Mm. And for Wales, 28 caps, but of course it would have been many more.
Well, I think it was only 17 peacetime caps plus all these wartime caps. Again, sadly for them, wartime caps don't count in the official records. And of course, back then, not as many international games took place. If he'd been playing now, he'd probably had well over 50 caps. It's just the way it was.
So what happened then after the war? Because all those greatest, I don't know, you could say the greatest years of his career were mixed up with the war. What happened after the war? Was he able to pick up where he left off?
Well, towards the end of the war, he suffered a nasty injury, and it was actually in a Merseyside derby, in a wartime derby. And that was the beginning of the end of his Everton career. It was an awful injury that he never fully got over. He played on for many years, but never quite the same. And he was also accused almost of feigning injury and being urged to go back on the pitch by an Everton director. And that sowed the seeds of discontent. And when Everton reconvened after the war, Tommy Lawton was allowed to go to Chelsea. Joe Mercer was effectively, they'd given up on him. They reckoned that he was crocked and no longer fit to play for Everton. And he went off to Arsenal and had great success. So you were left with some players who were over the hill, and then the great players still in their prime, like Sagar and TG, who were left trying to keep the boat afloat. And TG became increasingly disgruntled about that.
And one of the fascinating stories in the book concerns this period where he almost went and played in Italy, because it came quite close, didn't it, for him to join Roma?
Very close. I think TG had put in about 5 transfer requests, and they'd all been flatly refused, even though a whole host of top-flight clubs like Chelsea, like Arsenal, were wanting to take him. Everton wouldn't let him go. You know, as the club said, you're not going, you're not going. But then it came to the point where maybe the club were open to offers, and Roma came in with this then huge bid, and everybody seemed happy with it, TG, the club. But over red tape at the 11th hour meant that the deal fell through, and TG was left.
So he was happy to go.
Absolutely.
And because in those days, to move abroad would have been, particularly just after the war, would have been a huge change.
Almost unheard of. He'd have been one of the first, one of the pioneers. And of course, 10 years later, more or less, John Charles, that other great Welsh centre-half, did move to Italy and became a sensation with Juventus. And I'm sure TG always thought, you know, what might have been if he had been the person who had gone in 1948 and become the great star playing for Roma.
And it's ironic as well that the deal collapsed, and Everton, for whatever reason, but it seems as though Everton and Tommy G. Jones didn't get on, if you like.
No, there was a great deal of resentment, I think, from TG about the fact that the club wouldn't let him go. You know, in these days, you'd have your agent working overtime to to engineer a move. But in those days, the club would just say, no, we're renewing your contract for another year, you're staying. And then basically, in about 1949, he was made captain. It seemed like things had turned around, but he fell out with Cliff Britton, who had been brought in as the first proper modern team manager at Everton. Cliff Britton, of course, had been a teammate of Tommy before the war. But they fell out about the style of play. TG refused to compromise his elegant, sort of classy style of play. I think Britton wanted something a bit more pragmatic. And that really was the end. TG, in effect, walked away from the club at the end of the season.
So relations with Theo Kelly, mm-hmm, and then Cliff Britton weren't great either.
No, absolutely. Theo Kelly was the secretary manager, and then Cliff Britton came in as manager. Everton were on a downward spiral at that time. As I say, they'd lost their best players. They hadn't purchased wisely, and the club was beginning to be threatened with relegation. And there was just this parting of the ways became inevitable as 1950 dawned.
Mm. And then in 1950 he left Everton, but didn't. How old was he then? Was he beyond his best years?
He was 32, years? So yeah. I think it's fair to say his best years had been and gone. But the type of player he was, where he didn't have to depend on pace, he could use his intelligence. He believed that he could do another 2 or 3 years at the highest level. But he took a financial decision when it was given to him to walk away from football, effectively English football completely.
Yeah.
He actually doubled his money by leaving football and becoming a hotelier in Putaleli.
Yeah, so he did he play football there?
He did. He played. They had a League of Wales team called Putaleli FC, and so he managed the hotel and player managed the local football team, and he led them to unheralded success, 2 championships, won every cup going. You know, it was a revolution in that part of northwest Wales.
And with Bangor, Welsh Cup in 1962, and they beat. And this was the other big story, mm-hmm, the Napoli game with Bangor. They beat Napoli 2-0, didn't they?
They did.
He was the manager then.
Yeah, so TG was the manager. They'd won the Welsh Cup, which qualified them for the first time for the European Cup Winners' Cup. And in the draw, they got Napoli, this sort of bankrolled Italian giant. And of course, nobody gave Bangor, this Cheshire League team, a hope at all. But the Italians came to the Bangor City ground at Farrer Road, and Bangor turned them over 2-0. And of course, the away leg, everybody expected Napoli to get the revenge, but Banga only lost 3-1. So if you'd had the away goals rule,
of course, yeah,
Banga City would have gone through. But sadly, the away goals rule didn't come in for another 2 years or so. So they had to have a third deciding game at Highbury. So coach loads of Welsh people came down by car and by train to watch this game. And that again was so close. It was just lost by the odd goal. So fantastic memories. And still people in Bangor talk about those magnificent three games against Napoli.
And then what happened after that then? Did he carry on managing there?
TG carried on for a few more years at Bangor, but there was diminishing returns. He did, you know, he'd been there a decade, and a little bit maybe like David Moyes at Everton. After a while, you've been there a decade, you just come to that natural point where it's time to move on. He had a brief spell at Rill, who were the local rivals to Bangor, and that didn't go at all well. I think I likened it to Brian Clough going to Leeds. You don't sort of go to your bitter rivals. He lasted less than a season there.
More than 44 days, though.
Slightly more than 44 days, but not a season. And that was pretty much it. He had a brief spell at a small team called Bethesda a few years later. But after that, he focused on writing for the Daily Post, and he was very good at writing. You know, he was a clever guy, very eloquent. He did that for a few years and ran a news agency down by Bangor Pier with his wife. And that's what he did till within the last decade of his life.
And did he often come back to Goodison Park?
Rarely. Funnily enough, he applied to become manager of Everton in the mid-50s.
Really?
But he lost out to a chap called Ian Buchan, who wasn't even a football coach at the time. And that was probably the final straw for TG. So he probably only went to Goodison a handful of times after that. And, you know, it's sad to say that in his later years he was quite bitter about how he felt he'd been treated by Everton over the years. Mm.
Well, hopefully the book, Rob, will bring T.G. Jones back to life in a way and give him the sort of adulation for younger fans who are interested in the history of the club and some of the great players, because people who are Everton fans will know the name but not necessarily know all the details, and this hopefully will be able to do that.
Thank you. I mean, I'd like to think for younger fans, if they think of John Stones but twice as good, they're probably in the right ballpark.
So what would he be worth nowadays?
He'd be playing at Barcelona or Real Madrid.
Yeah.
And, you know, 100 million.
Because, again, the comparison is often made with Beckenbauer. He was a precursor to Beckenbauer.
That sort of libero, that guy who could defend but then just pick up the ball and dribble it and start attacks. He was just that all-round complete player.
Mm. I was going to ask you, actually, Rob, TG's family involved in the research of the book?
Yeah, his surviving daughter, who still lives in Bangor, was very helpful. She had photos that I've used in the book, and also just sort of memories of family life, plus cousins and nephews and nieces. So, yes, I managed to track down as many family members as possible.
And there's some great photographs in the book as well. And quite often, you know, in the 30s and the 40s, you see footballers and they always seem to have big overcoats on, don't they?
Yeah, the camel hair coats, yes.
But, yeah, and he was a good-looking guy.
He was good-looking, and I think it's fair to say he knew it, but he was always immaculate. You know, he looked almost like the country gent when you look at some of the photos. And when we were talking before about, you know, how much he'd be worth today, he wouldn't just be worth a lot. He'd be a star because of his image. Just everything about him would have made him famous.
The station that's first for football.
BBC Radio Merseyside.